This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Snymer. Will you be seeing older relatives over the holidays? Experts say it's the perfect time to spot signs of frailty or decline and to make a plan to deal with it. And detectives recently solved a trio of cold murder cases after more than 40 years. We'll explain the advanced DNA technology that made it possible. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. Quebec is the only province to reject funding for a Health Canada-approved Alzheimer's drug, saying its benefits are too modest to improve patients' lives. The province's National Institute for Excellence in Health and Social Services rejected the drug, which sells under the brand name Leqembi, saying it didn't pass the first test of providing clear therapeutic value. Health Canada approved Leqembi in October, saying that while it does not cure or halt the decline associated with Alzheimer's, it does slow progression on average by 27%. Leqembi will be available in Canada next month for those who have private insurance or the means to pay out of pocket. Cost is around $32,000 per year. According to Stats Canada, June and December are the top 2 months for Canadians to retire. Leaving your full-time job at the end of the year can have advantages, primarily from a tax standpoint, but there may be an emotional downside. Many will kick off their retirement with a trip or event, but when they come back to reality, find that shorter, colder days of winter can be a depressing time to start the next phase of life. December retirees also shift from getting an employee paycheck with all taxes withheld to income from multiple sources, including workplace and government pensions and investments. From a tax perspective, though, financial experts call a December retirement a clean slate for the next year. It's a one-of-a-kind Christmas tree. The Goa-based Crochet Collective has made a multi-hued 18-foot crochet Christmas tree. It was put together by 25 women from across the state with 1,000 granny squares crocheted in acrylic yarn that can withstand Goa's humidity and monsoon better than traditional wool. The self-funded project was made in 3 months. A letter written by Mary Queen of Scots just hours before her execution is to go on display for the first time in nearly a decade. Mary penned what is believed to be her last letter in French at 2 a.m. on Wednesday, the 8th of February, 1587, when she wrote to her brother-in-law, Henri III of France, to put her affairs in order. Her execution at Fotheringay Castle in Northamptonshire took place just 6 hours later. The letter is held by the National Library of Scotland and rarely leaves its vaults, primarily for conservation reasons. It will go on display at the Perth Museum next year. British-born zoologist Ian Douglas-Hamilton, founder of the organization Save the Elephants, has died at the age of 83. Douglas Hamilton was known for decades of conservation work, including pioneering the use of trackers and collars to protect elephants against poaching. His work led to a crucial decision in 1989 to ban the international ivory trade. The Uganda Conservation Foundation praised the life and work of Douglas Hamilton, saying he didn't just protect elephants, but also empowered the people protecting them. He is survived by his wife, 2 daughters, and 6 grandchildren. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. As Canadians prepare for the holiday season, many will be spending longer in-person time with their parents and grandparents, in some cases, for the only time during the year. These moments are crucial in noticing changes that can signal decline, changes that would not be as readily apparent over phone calls or quick check-ins. I talked with Dr. Howard Chertkow, a practicing cognitive neurologist at Toronto's Baycrest Health Sciences Center, about what to look for.
The first thing that I always say is we've got to cut people some slack over the holidays because people arrive, they've been traveling, they're tired, they're maybe in different surroundings, maybe they're taking sleeping pills. So people are not at their best. There's no doubt about that. But the important thing is to look for change. Someone, for example, when I've had a situation of the kids visiting from Vancouver, they say, our mother couldn't put on the big meal. She puts on the big meal every holiday season, and now she couldn't do it. So change in performance, the mother just couldn't organize. This is called executive function, and this is one of the early changes we see in dementia. Or they say, my mother couldn't remember who was my sister, who I was, who are our children. Important changes in memory and changes in behavior. You know, the person is much more agitated or anxious or apathetic. So what you should be looking for is change from how they were before, because change is not always, but often a harbinger of brain disease.
Well, I think the things that you just mentioned are very different. Now, for instance, in terms of preparing a big meal, I know people, I mean, usually they let you know in advance, like that's one of the things they let go. They just say, you know what? I can't do this anymore. And it certainly doesn't show any cognitive decline. In fact, sometimes the opposite, where they're aware of what their limitations are. And it's certainly not the same as not recognizing people.
Yeah, but people can let go for different reasons. You're quite right. First of all, there can be physical problems. A parent has arthritis or trouble walking or balance. That's a different kettle of fish. But when the parent or grandparent says, I just can't get it together to do this anymore, that's a red flag. And obviously, it could be any number of reasons, but that's one of the red flags we look for. It's a change in function. Just like if the parent says, I just can't pay my bills now, I have trouble, I can't get on the internet, I can't handle the ATM, I can't organize my medications. But the problem is often that the person who's having cognitive problems, brain problems, may not be aware of it or may minimize it or deny it. It's often the family or the family members are much more aware than the person involved. So that leads into a very delicate situation of what should the family do, what should the kids do, what should they say, how they should handle it.
Now, one of the things I noticed when my mother-in-law, who had Alzheimer's, was alive, was isolation. So that if people had been isolated because of winter and had not interacted with others for a while, you know, when you saw them, their cognition would be lower, but sometimes it kind of came back after they spent a little time around people.
That's a very important observation. It's quite correct. Look, things that make people can have mild dementia, and it's made worse by a number of things. They're lonely, if they're isolated, if they're just not talking to people, if they're depressed. Many people get depressed. If they're not sleeping, if they're not eating, if they're losing weight, all of those things are going to impact on brain function. So we like to test people at their best, realizing that there are times, everyone has their ups and downs, and we try to assess people when they're at their best and see if even at their best, they're worse than they were before. If you detect changes in your older family members, the important thing is not to try and push them, try harder to remember. That's not how it works. The thing to do is to gently and compassionately say, look, we're noticing some change. We think you should see your doctor. and go with a family member. Make sure the person goes with a family member who says family is noticing memory changes and we think they should be looked into. Because there are many times when we find things that are treatable, depression, lack of sleep, low thyroid, there are a number of conditions that can be treated. A doctor has to do the testing, do the blood test, and then come to a conclusion whether there's something more serious involved. So I think it's important not to just assume this is normal aging and this is normal senility, or assume there's nothing that can be done. Some people just have a nihilistic view that there's nothing we can do. That's just not true. As far as things to do to stimulate people, social stimulation by being with your family and friends, physical stimulation by exercising. Exercise takes 5 years off your brain age, and cognitive stimulation. We don't want older people or people at any age to be sitting on the couch just watching Judge Judy. You need to be doing something to challenge your brain and find something you're interested in that makes you think and builds your brain connections and keeps your brain as healthy as possible.
What are the key things to look for?
So the key things are change from the previous level of memory function, and not change in a minor way. Okay, you can't remember when, you know, your grandchildren's birthday was, or you can't remember some minor headline, but an important change that the parent is forgetting the holidays, forgetting the family members, mixing them up. And when you have a conversation, even hours later, the person doesn't remember the conversation. Those are important red flags. And as I mentioned, the other red flag is inability to organize their day, to look after themselves, their medications, pay their bills. A lot of people, older people, are failing to pay their bills correctly and getting involved in scams. These are also red flags that their thinking isn't as clear as it used to be. And change in behavior and psychology. Someone becoming more agitated, more anxious, losing their temper, where in fact previously they were very even-tempered and never did this. So change in behavior and change emotionally, these are more red flags that suggest maybe it's something in the brain.
Okay, and as you said, it might be something that is treatable.
Yes, and you know, even Alzheimer's disease, if I would have been here talking to you 10, 15 years ago, I would have said, look, all we have are treatments for the symptoms of Alzheimer's that improve people a little bit for a few months. But now we're in the age where we're starting to get the disease-modifying therapies, drugs coming down, which can, in some people, slow the progression or even stabilize the illness. Not in everyone, and they're not a home run, but the first anti-amyloid drug has been approved by Health Canada. So I think it's a time when really people who are having early dementia, their families must make sure they get to a doctor. And people, we're learning more and more about prevention. Even people with mild memory loss benefit from prevention lifestyle strategies. At Baycrest, we've opened the Kimmel Center for Brain Health, which is a dementia prevention center where we encourage better diet, exercise, better sleep, and the cognitive stimulation that we think even in people with mild memory loss will slow the progression. So there's a lot that people can do. If you go on the Baycrest website, we've made 15 little videos of lifestyle things, interventions that everybody can do to maintain their brain health. So that's a good place to start looking.
Okay. Well, it sounds like very good advice and something to keep in mind as we celebrate with all generations of the family. Dr. Howard Chertkow, thanks so much.
Delighted to be here. Have a good holiday.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Howard Chertkow of Toronto's Baycrest Health Sciences Center. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, how Toronto police solved cold cases going back more than four decades.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
After more than 40 years, police identified Kenneth Smith as the murderer in three cold cases of homicide perpetrated between 1982 and 1997. The DNA technique, forensic genetic genealogy, was used to identify him as the killer of Christine Prince, Gracelyn Greenidge, and Claire Sampson. I asked Detective Sergeant Steve Smith to explain this fascinating technique that can help give families closure after all these decades.
The way we use DNA in criminal cases is it's sequenced in a sort of way to give us a one-to-one comparison that we can use in court. What we do in genetic genealogy is we sequence it in a different way that allows us to use familial ties in order to identify family relations of the offender, the unknown offender that had left his DNA at the crime scene. And that's exactly what we did in this case. Once we sequence it in the different type, it's called a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism, we can upload that SNP to certain genealogy websites in the U.S. When we do upload, then what we get in return is a list of relatives out to six cousins. And anybody that's uploaded to those systems that is related to our unknown profile will allow us to start building a family tree to determine where in that family our offender is.
Once you find a person, do they have to agree to submit their DNA, or how does that work?
So usually it'll bring us into a family. So we'll have a family of people that could have left this DNA at the scene. From there, we go back to traditional policing. We either execute a DNA warrant, we ask people to voluntarily provide their DNA, and or we find another way to gather their DNA. In this case, the person was deceased, so we had to write a warrant for some genetic material that was kept from his autopsy, and that's how we were able to determine that he was, without a doubt, our offender.
And how long did that process take with this case?
So this case, I mean, it's been a long process. We've been working on it since 2017. We first engaged genetic genealogy in 2022, but we had a complex mixture of DNA. So it wasn't until 2025 that we were actually able to get that DNA to a point where it was useful to us with SNP testing. And once we did, it actually went pretty quickly because of matches on the maternal side and the paternal side. It very quickly led us to the family of interest.
What do you mean by a complex mixture of DNA?
Because we've had a fight or a stabbing or that sort of murder, we get sometimes the offender's DNA mixed with the victim's DNA. And to be able to sequence it, we have to be able to separate the offender's DNA from the victim's DNA and sole source our offender's DNA to get them up on the websites. If you have a mixture, it doesn't really work because it'll give you false positives in regards to the family members.
Now, the family members of the women who were murdered, what kind of reaction do you usually get when they get a name after all of this time?
Yeah, I mean, every family's different, but mostly when we are able to call them and tell them that we know the person that committed this offense against their loved ones, it's usually a very favorable reaction. I mean, it's very emotional, obviously, especially after all these years, not knowing whether this would ever be solved or not. And I mean, in reality, if a close member of your family is killed, there's probably a lot of suspicion on people around that person. So to find out it's somebody that wasn't related and or a friend of the deceased really makes a difference to the families.
And in this case, you know, there was one case a few years ago where the perpetrator was alive and charged. This case, he died back in 2019. How does that impact things?
Well, it is frustrating for investigators. It's also most likely frustrating for the families because they don't see this person actually have to come before the justice system and hear and, you know, be sentenced for what they did. So, I mean, it is great to know who it was, but it's a bit bittersweet knowing that they're already deceased and they don't have to face justice for the crimes that they committed.
And you're looking at this person, Kenneth Smith, possibly he's responsible for some other involved murders as well. Is that right?
Well, we want to make sure that we aren't missing anything. I mean, we want to cover every minute that he wasn't in jail, and we want to make sure that he wasn't committing any other sexually based offenses and or murders in those times. So we want to speak to anybody that may have known Kenneth, anybody that had any involvement with Kenneth, and anybody that may have been victimized by him that at the time they didn't feel comfortable coming forward, but they do now.
Beyond the fact that it was a sexual nature of the crime, is there anything, any commonality among these three murders?
There was not. I mean, they were very different women, different lifestyles, different ages, different ethnicities. It was everything in these cases was very different. It seems like it was crimes of opportunity for our offender. So, however he came upon these women and they were susceptible at that time, he took advantage of that and abducted and or sexually assaulted the women.
How many cases do you have in a backlog that you're hoping to solve this way?
So in Toronto, for homicides, we have over 800 unsolved homicides, about 32 unidentified human remains to still identify, and we have probably upwards of 500 to 1,000 sexual assaults, and that's just in Toronto.
How many do you get through, say, in a year?
Well, we're lucky enough to have funding from the Ontario government. The Solicitor General's office has provided us funding to utilize this technique. And we try to put forward about 36 cases a year if we can, depending how far the money stretches for us. And right now we're at close to a 50% solve rate on those cases that we're putting forward.
That's incredible. What would you like to leave us with about this technology?
Just that it's made unsolvable cases solvable again. I mean, a lot of these cases that have gone cold over the years, we can now go back, readdress them, retest, find offender DNA, and doesn't matter how old it is, we can either identify somebody that's previously been unidentified, or we can identify an offender that committed offenses from long ago.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Detective Sergeant Steve Smith. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That was Detective Sergeant Steve Smith on using DNA technology to solve cold cases. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer, and thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.